From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
This is Carol Spooner. Today, we actually put on record a settlement agreement that achieves more than we could ever have achieved at trial, that gives us an opportunity to restore Pacifica to its mission. I am absolutely overjoyed.
The four lawsuits against Pacifica Radio are dropped as all parties sign an agreement to democratize the network. And as the world pays new attention to women in Afghanistan, we'll hear Muslim women debate feminism and fundamentalism. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. planes today began blasting the mountain hideouts of trapped al-Qaeda fighters after the expiration of a surrender-or-die ultimatum from the U.S.-backed Afghan forces besieging them. Al-Qaeda forces had previously said they would only surrender in the presence of U.N. troops and diplomats from their own countries to prevent them from being massacred by U.S.-backed mujahideen as they had been in the northern part of the country. Amidst the bombing, the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden are still unknown. According to conflicting newspaper reports, he has both fled to neighboring Pakistan and remains in the Tora Bora Mountains, where his forces are holed up, with a final push against bin Laden's forces likely. UN Security Council members are negotiating a resolution that would authorize a multinational peacekeeping force for Afghanistan. Britain, which will lead the force, is scrambling to get a contingent of troops from mainly NATO nations into Afghanistan by December 22nd, when the new interim government is to take office. British and U.S. special forces, along with CIA operatives, began a visible presence in Kandahar yesterday after staffing checkpoints outside the city to search for al-Qaeda fighters and senior Taliban members. The patrols began despite U.S. forces spokesmen at the American Marine base at Camp Rhino, southern Afghanistan, saying they'd no intention of entering the city. A B-1 bomber crashed into the Indian Ocean yesterday after its engines failed 30 miles north of the British airbase at Diego Garcia. All four crew members were rescued. It was the first loss of a fixed-wing aircraft in the conflict. The B-1 had been taking part in the same bombing missions in Afghanistan as B-52 and B-2 bombers. Government officials have acknowledged that for nearly a decade, U.S. Army scientists at Dugway Proving Ground in Utah have made weapons-grade anthrax that's virtually identical to the powdery spores used in recent mail attacks that have killed five people. Until the anthrax attacks led to tighter security measures, anthrax grown at Dugway was regularly sent by Federal Express to the Army's Biodefense Center at Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland, where the bacteria were killed using gamma radiation before being returned to Dugway for experiments. Dugway's production of weapons-grade anthrax, which has never before been publicly revealed, is apparently the first by the U.S. government since President Richard Nixon ordered the U.S. Offensive Biowarfare Program closed in 1969. 10 Israelis were killed and up to 30 wounded, many critically, when Palestinian gunmen ambushed their bus as it was passing the ultra-Orthodox Jewish settlement of Emmanuel near Nablus. The killings immediately triggered a wave of bombing raids by Israeli warplanes. Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority, facing massive international pressure to clamp down on militants, immediately ordered the closure of all offices of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, the groups that have claimed responsibility for the wave of recent attacks. But in a decision with ominous implications, Israel's cabinet last night voted to sever ties with Yasser Arafat and to launch wide-scale military operations against cities in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. In related news, some 60 Israelis who federal investigators have said are part of a long-running effort to spy on U.S. government officials are among the hundreds of foreigners detained since the September 11th attacks. The Israelis, a handful of whom are described as active Israeli military or intelligence operatives, have been detained on immigration charges or under the new Patriot anti-terrorism law. There's no indication the Israelis were involved in the September 11th attacks, but investigators suspect they may have gathered intelligence about the attacks in advance and not shared it. The chair and a leading member of the extremist Jewish Defense League were charged yesterday in a bombing plot aimed at the office of an Arab American congressman and a prominent Los Angeles mosque. JDL Chair Irv Rubin and Earl Krugel were held without bail after being arrested Tuesday after explosive powder was delivered to Krugel's home by a longtime JDL member who'd turned federal informant. Other bomb components and weapons were seized at Krugel's home. Authorities said the two men held a series of meetings in October to plan the bombing of the King Fahd Mosque and the San Clemente office of freshman Congressmember Daryl Issa of California. Half a dozen armed men stormed India's sprawling parliament building today, leaving at least 13 dead in a more than half-hour shootout. Parliament was adjourned at the time of the attack, but most lawmakers were still inside. The killings are being called the worst breach of government security since the assassination of the Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi in 1984. New Delhi's police chief said six police officers and an army commando and all six of the gunmen were killed in the attack, whose cause is still unknown. And finally, congressional lawmakers hammered Enron's corporate auditor in hearings on Capitol Hill yesterday, charging that executives of the now bankrupt energy giant enriched themselves through illegal insider trading and slick financial gimmicks while running the energy trading company into the ground. Enron chair and CEO Kenneth Lay, a key Bush ally, refused an invitation to appear before the House committee.
One that's done all the things you set out to do. Stand.
There's a cross for you to bear.
Things to go through if you're going anywhere.
The things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal. Stand and
everybody, yeah.
And they know what you're saying makes sense at all. Stand.
Don't you know that you are free?
Well, at least in your mind, if you want to be.
Stand. Sly and the Family Stone here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An historic agreement was reached yesterday between all plaintiffs in four lawsuits against the five-station Pacifica Radio Network and the Pacifica Foundation's Board of Directors. The agreement returns official control of the Pacifica Network, the nation's oldest public broadcaster, to community radio advocates. Yesterday's settlement calls for an interim board controlled by the current minority to serve for 15 months while new democratic structures are implemented for an elected national Pacifica board. The agreement brings to an end 2.5 years of legal, political, and community struggle following an illegal change in the method of selecting Pacifica's directors, who traditionally have been elected by the local station boards. In the last 2.5 years, Pacifica's banned and fired dozens of broadcasters and incurred millions of dollars in expenditures due to high fees paid to corporate lawyers, public relations companies, and security firms. Pacifica's finances have not been disclosed to either board members or donors in over a year. But at the last board meeting in Washington in November, it was reported that the foundation has over $1 million in unpaid current accounts in addition to $2 million in pending legal fees. The settlement comes Just a day after it became public that the National Program Director, Utrice Lead, had resigned her post after only 2 months on the job. Lead was first installed as WBAI General Manager almost a year ago after she helped carry out last December's so-called Christmas coup at New York Pacifica Station WBAI. Senior Pacifica management changed the locks in the middle of the night, installed security guards and cameras, fired or banned more than 24 producers and staff. According to recently released Arbitron estimates, nearly 1 year after the dramatic management changes and mass firings at Pacifica, the network's audience figures have dropped sharply. At WBAI in New York and KPFT in Houston, the listening audience plunged by more than a third. Pacifica managers had claimed they'd instituted changes at the network in order to expand and broaden audience. Critics said Pacifica wanted to mainstream the programming. Well, we thought we would start today at KPFA, where it all began. Both the network itself in 1946 and 1949, KPFA went on the air. And 2 years ago, when between 10 and 15,000 people marched in the streets to reopen the first Pacifica station after it had been chained shut by Pacifica management. We're going to go to a program that KPFA had on last night, Flashpoints, and all of the plaintiffs who had come forward after the agreement was reached to speak.
Afraid to speak truth to the power, took on McCarthy and Hoover too. They were even firebombed by the coup. Klux Klan, that is. Anyone pissing off that many right-wing nutballs must be doing something right. So I tuned on in to get the word, and I couldn't believe what my own ears heard. I began to cry and to despair, because KPFA was off the air. Taped filler, canned crop, on the public airway.
And that was a song, Talking Free Speech Radio Blues, by Jamie Brockett. My name is Noelle Hanrahan, and you're listening to Flashpoints on KPFA. This is Pacifica Watch. The litigants who've been battling to save the last independent radio network in the country, Pacifica, and return our venerable six-station network to its historic mission have reached an agreement settling the lawsuit, seating a new interim board of the Pacifica Foundation, and beginning the work of returning the network to its mission to be an alternative voice of peace with justice. We now go to the voices of Carol Spooner, plaintiff in the listener lawsuit, Robbie Osman, host of Across the Great Divide on KPFA, and Dave Adelson, chair of the KPFK Advisory Board and plaintiff in the Local Advisory Board lawsuit. They came to KPFA's studios directly from the Alameda County Courthouse.
Hi, this is Carol Spooner. Today, we actually put on record a settlement agreement that achieves more than we could ever have achieved at trial. That gives us an opportunity to restore Pacifica to its mission. I am absolutely overjoyed, as a matter of fact. We achieved more than I ever thought we could do without trial. We do have control of the board of directors. We do have wonderful, vibrant people who will be on this board, committed to working hard over the next 15 months as an interim board to solve the problems that have been created. And just thank you to Sherry and to Dan Siegel and to all the lawyers, and Robbie and Barbara, friends of Free Speech Radio, who have helped us through this long struggle. It has been a privilege and an honor to serve.
Robbie Osman, who, as many of you know, is the host of Across the Great Divide, a longtime volunteer at KPFA.
Yeah, we should lay out for folks exactly what this settlement looks like so we know where it is and what's real here. There will be 15 people on a board, five of them selected by the people who had been the majority of the board, five of them selected by the people who have been the dissidents of the board, and five selected by the chairs of the LABs, by the chairs of the presently existing local advisory boards. Of those five, that last group, we expect four to be clearly progressive people, and one coming from a Houston board that we haven't been very close to, not necessarily so. That makes 9-6 in our favor, and that's a powerful margin. Decisions will be made in one of the following ways. Either we will get two-thirds of the people voting in present, or we will get a majority of the people voting in present that includes one person from each of those three groups, or we will get a simple majority that's approved by the judge. Our expectation is that the judge will not stand in the way of a reasonable decision by the majority, and will not be inclined to stand in the way of reasonable decisions of the majority. So we think that the good guys control the board, and we can just begin to start moving towards thinking about what Pacifica needs to be, what Pacifica ought to be, and where we need to go.
Hi, my name's Dave Adelson, and people are pointing at me, so I assume that means they want me to talk to you. I'm chair of the KPFK Local Advisory Board in Los Angeles, and was one of the people involved in the Local Advisory Board lawsuit. I just want to say that I see this as an opening, as a very positive opening. 3 years ago, when people were within the institution were behaving in very high-handed manner, removing people, ignoring complaints, ignoring the communities, and perpetrating all manner of assaults on what I understood to be the mission, I never thought that we would see this day. And I'm very grateful to everybody out there who participated in it. I want to say that this will constitute a win. When you, who are listening, are able to make demands on the station and not be told politely to go away or not be ignored, but this acts as your radio station. So please stay involved. We'll need you.
And that was the voice of Dave Adelson, chair of the KPFK Local Advisory Board. And we're joined in the studio now by Carol Spooner, plaintiff in the listener's lawsuit, Leslie Kagan, dissident Pacifica Foundation National Board member, Barbara Lubin, plaintiff and member of Friends of Free Speech Radio, and Matthew Lazar, a historian of Pacifica and former KPFA news guy. So, Leslie, I'd like to start with you and your reactions to today's announcement.
Well, I want to start by saying that you just called me the dissident board member. I think actually that's changed. I'm now a majority board member. I am, aside from being totally exhausted by this whole process and wondering where I and all the rest of us are going to get the energy to do all the work ahead of us, but putting that aside for a moment, I am quite profoundly happy. I don't think, by no stretch of the imagination have we won everything. What we've done is opened up a door. We took advantage of a little crack that was open, and we opened the door way big, way wide. And now we, and by we, I don't just mean the interim board that's being put together, but I mean the family, the community of Pacifica, all around the country. Now we all have to walk through that door with as much clarity and commitment and dedication to the tasks that we have ahead of us. So what happened today, it shifted the terrain so that now we can begin the rebuilding process. And that's good news. That's good news for all of us.
Now, Matthew Lazar, tell us what was at stake in terms of Pacifica's mission.
I believe that this settlement and the excellent work which these people have done, congratulations to you. You are my heroes. Quite literally delivers this organization from the gates of hell. For the first time in, almost 3 years, I can go to bed tonight sure and confident that I will not wake up tomorrow morning or the day after that or the day after that and find out from the grapevine that one of the Pacifica stations is actually being put up for sale, that the organization isn't about to be dismantled and integrated into the extant public corporate broadcasting network. I feel for the first time in a very long time that the organization is safe in a fundamental sense from that fate. And for that reason alone, it's really, really terribly important. It's also important because at the same time that the organization is now going to work on this settlement, the external situation is once again getting very, very hot. I mean, we have an attorney general right now who says that criticism of him or his policies are essentially treasonous, and who wants to open up the FBI to allowing investigation of political and religious organizations again. And of course, if those things happen, who is the national security state going to go after first? It's going to go after the Pacifica Radio Network. So having a national board that is sympathetic to the mission of the organization, I think is very important at this particular time. I'm very, very relieved that this has happened.
Now, Barbara Lubin from Friends of Free Speech Radio and Leslie Kagan, you are both veterans of progressive movements over the decades, and you've seen a lot of winning and losing. What do you think it's going to take from our listeners to make sure that what we get means that we are able to stay true to our mission? Barbara?
Hi. I don't know whether I can answer that. What I can say is that the listeners, us listeners, those of us in the community who aren't on the board, who aren't on the LAB, who don't work at the station, it is we who helped win this, every single one of us. And this struggle is definitely not over. We have to be the overseers of what takes place over the next year. We have to be organizing in our community and in all of the communities, the Pacifica communities, to get people on the LABs, to get prepared over this year to have the elections in all the other listening areas. We have a lot of work ahead of us, and we have to continue to hold our board members, wonderful as they are, some of them, hold their feet to the fire, because we have to be vigilant. And finally, I do want to say that it's so wonderful, and it's a relief to me to be in the station tonight and not be here screaming at everybody, either on air or in everybody's studio, saying, don't fundraise, don't fundraise. I've been screaming that for 2.5 years, and now it's such a wonderful place to be able to say, okay, now is the time to rebuild our network, rebuild our stations. I'm wearing earphones that are falling off. This studio needs a lot of help and repair. We need to pay salaries. There's so much and so much reason to give our money today to our beloved KPFA.
And that was Barbara Lubin, a member of Friends of Free Speech Radio, in the studio at KPFA yesterday with other plaintiffs in the lawsuits that have now been dropped against Pacifica Radio. Leslie Kagan, a dissident Pacifica board member, Matthew Lazar, historian of Pacifica, Dave Adelson, chair of the Pacifica Station KPFK Local Advisory Board and plaintiff in the Local Advisory Board lawsuit, Robbie Osman, host of Across the Great Divide on KPFA, and Carol Spooner, the lead plaintiff in the listener lawsuit against Pacifica. As we wrap up this segment, we go on the telephone to Bernard White, who is the fired program director of WBAI in New York. Among the hot issues that the Pacifica Foundation must now resolve are the issue of the fired and the banned. Bernard, your response to the settlement that was announced yesterday.
Okay. First of all, thanks for inviting me. We've heard the theory. Now we have to see the practice. This new configuration of the board has to be able to address the concerns of each of the radio stations, and the concerns are different. At BAI, one of the major concerns is the return of the fired and the banned, and the removal of any illegal hires, the removal of the gag rule, and a return to the mission. So now we have to see whether or not these folks who took a gamble, whether they can deliver now. And I agree with Barbara Lubin in that one of the things that we did is we turned our back on the national board. We weren't paying very close attention to what it was they were doing. And I think that the listeners have to, as well as the staff, has to remain vigilant and constantly monitor what's happening on a national level. The association between the local advisory boards and the national board has to be reestablished so that circle of information and influence can be back in place. It provides a check and a balance on how decisions are made. So I think that whether we like it or not, this is what we got. Now we'll have to work with it. There's been a special committee that's been set or will be set up to deal specifically with WBAI. And how BAI is dealt with will portend how the rest of the network gets dealt with. So,
well, Bernard, thanks very much. Bernard White, fired program director at WBAI. Among the hot issues that are listed in the settlement are the resolution of the issue of the banned and the fired, the return of the banned and the fired. Among the other issues are the stringer strike against Pacifica Network News. For more than a year, journalists have struck against PNN, among other issues, over censorship. And we'll deal with these issues in the coming days. We hope also to return Democracy Now! To the full Pacifica network. KPFA has been broadcasting us on its own airwaves with KFCF and Pacifica affiliates around the country. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute with a roundtable of Islamic women talking about feminism and fundamentalism. Stay with us. Listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the last 3 months, as the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan has escalated, the situation of Muslim women has taken center stage. With many Afghan men killed in fighting, women now make up 54% of Afghanistan's population. Many Afghan women have led lives constrained by both ancient customs and poverty. The female literacy rate is less than 5%. But before the country was devoured by violence, Afghan women were granted the vote in 1929 in a constitutional monarchy. The Afghan king made the headscarf, sometimes known as a burqa, optional in 1959. The country's constitution institutionalized women's right to education. By 1979, half of college students in Kabul were female. Before the Mujahideen took over the country in 1992, women accounted for 70% of teachers, half the government workers, 40% of medical doctors, those figures according to the United Nations. The debate over women's role in Islamic societies has long been an issue discussed by women. Last week on the program, we began a discussion about fundamentalism and freedom with two Muslim women. We continue that conversation today. We're going to talk about wearing the hijab, one of the most heated discussions between Muslim women, especially in this country. Some say the practice of covering the head symbolizes Americans' unease over the role of women in Muslim societies. Others say wearing the hijab or head covering, traditional to women in Islam, is liberating. We're going to start off by talking to Leila El-Wafi. She joins us in our Firehouse studio right now, a caseworker at the Arab American Family Support Center. You wear the hijab. Can you, first of all, describe it for us, for the listeners who don't get to see you on television, as we're broadcasting on TV also, and then talk about why you wear it.
Right. Thank you, Amy. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and to speak out, you know, on this topic. I think oftentimes people get this image that's very skewed and, you know, you don't really get a proper understanding of it. The hijab or the head covering that I wear is oftentimes traditionally a black cloth that I'll, you know, wrap around my hair. And sometimes, as today, I'm wearing a golden one with a little pattern on it. It really comes in all sorts of styles and shapes, and I really, I match it with what I'm wearing, and I don't feel that, you know, it's something that needs to be restricted to one color, or, you know, some women do like to maintain a traditional attire about it. But I chose to wear hijab. I was born and raised in America, although my parents came here from the Middle East and raised us with conservative, traditional Arabic and Islamic values. But I chose to wear it. My sister does not. And it really was a choice that I made a few years ago. And in a sense, I do feel liberated by it. I don't oftentimes I think that the hijab has become this symbol of how East versus West, you know, how the cultures and the values are in conflict. And I think that that's a shame. It's really used as a tool, and women are oppressed in many ways in many parts of the world under many different ideological or political or religious systems. And I don't think that the hijab relates to an oppression. I think that in the religion of Islam, like in many other faiths and traditional systems, there's a spirit of modesty and a spirit of respect and dignity that people abide by in their actions and in how they dress. And the hijab just symbolizes this sort of spirit, and women apply it, you know, as they see fit. It is their choice. I do feel that it is a part of the religion and it is required. But, you know, as I said, every person has their choice.
We're also joined by Zuvia Hamid, who is a writer and medical doctor originally from Pakistan. You're not wearing a hijab.
No, I grew up in Peshawar in Pakistan, and people at this point have become very familiar with Peshawar. As you know, it is in the northwest frontier province, which is right next to Afghanistan. I think that this hijab bit has been, you know, it is a very cultural issue. I don't think it has anything to do with Islam. Nowhere in the Quran does it state that you should be covering your head. Most women who want to cover their head do it for other reasons. I mean, there are multiple reasons. For instance, if you look at Benazir Bhutto, who grew up in an extremely westernized and an extremely liberated atmosphere, and her father, I want you to remember that, had groomed her, even though he did have two sons, to essentially become the leader that she became. I mean, his role in making her what she became was extremely important. She covered her head simply to get votes and simply to manipulate the situation. So just to say that it is a symbol of modesty, I think it's an over-exaggeration. Yes, indeed, it is used in certain parts to suppress women, and quite often it is used by women to suppress other women. So the hijab is multi-layered. In the United States at this point, what I see some of the younger girls, like Layla, wearing it, I think they're doing it to discover their own identity, or to, I mean, I can't think of it as liberating. I mean, I guess I do know people who find, you know, body piercing very liberating. So if people want to do it one way or the other, I think I can understand that. But to label it as something Islamic, I think is incorrect.
Your response?
Well, my response to that is that, like I previously said, that I think that in Islam, it's a very, it's a religion that respects the individual and respects his or her choice. And we believe that each person has their own accountability, and really the choices that you make are your own. And so I believe to enforce it on other people is wrong. But again, I do feel that it has founding in the religion. Although, like my co-panelists said, that there are misuses of it, and there are definite you know, cultural aspects of it that may not necessarily be a part of the religion. But to say that it's not liberating, I disagree. I mean, I feel growing up in this society, and just even I have visited the Middle East, and, you know, have worn it there, and I feel that it is liberating from certain you know, standards of just how women are very sexualized in society. And it's very, I feel that I command respect from people when I interact with them in public, and people have told me that, and it really doesn't hold me back from participating in any sort of physical activities. I've, you know, competed in marathons. I go to the gym regularly. I, you know, speak out. I socialize regularly. I don't think that, you know, and I, at the same time, I feel that how I choose to present myself in this form really does allow me to make a statement and to command a certain level of respect from people, particularly men.
What did you think, Layla, when you heard about or saw on television women in Afghanistan who were wearing the full body covering, the burqa, taking it off and talking about the liberation that they felt?
You know, I'm beyond words for the sadness and the grief that I feel for the women in Afghanistan. I feel that they've been through a lot, and they it's a gross example of how the hijab has been manipulated and how it has been enforced upon women. And I sympathize with them. And if, you know, I understand that when they take it off, it's a symbol, it's a political statement as well as, you know, an actual physical statement of taking it off and feeling free and feeling as if they have a choice.
Let me bring our guest on the telephone into the conversation, who we were joined by a few days ago, Mirnaz Saeed Vafa, filmmaker, professor at the Department of Film and Video at Columbia College in Chicago, made the film Tajik Women, which we watched and heard on the program a few days ago. Your response to the conversation so far?
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
It's good to have you with us.
Want to just respond to a couple of points that the other speakers brought up. One is the idea of liberation. I feel that liberation is a very deep concept for me, and therefore it has to come from a deep place too. It cannot just happen from outside. And wearing hijab is... right now, it has become an ideological symbol that you wear it. It's like, you know, you are declaring to the world what you believe in. So it has become a little bit, you know, more than what, you know, probably originally has been. But, you know, what I want to, you know, say about hijab is that, you know, it has to be, as the other speaker also noted, it has to be a matter of choice. And so that people who are, for example, minority who live in a Muslim society, and people who, you know, choose not to wear it, they would not be harmed by that society. I think that, you know, that level of choice or tolerance should be reserved. And I don't think that hijab by itself necessarily is a symbol of repression or freedom necessarily, because, you know, there are a whole set of other laws that comes that we never speak about that could be, you know, liberating or repressing. For example, the family law, the right of custody of the children, the right of divorce, heritage, criminal justice, and an area of political participation of women, and also education. As you have seen, you know, for example, under Taliban, women were deprived of education, and this is not Islamic. This is their interpretation. So it's those other areas that I feel that, you know, except for this recently talking about Taliban, nobody has spoke about, and they, you know, in the West, we just talk about hijab, and there are so many other areas that we really need to, you know, focus on.
Zuvia Hamid.
You know, I'd like to talk about all this liberating bit about the hijab and to say that it's a choice. I mean, you know, there's I think this is a lot of rubbish going on over here, because we do know that Muslim schools, even here in the United States, are insisting, and this is part of the school uniforms for four-year-olds, for five-year-olds, children who do not have any sexual identity, to start wearing the scarf on the head. So what do you mean by liberating? I mean, I'd like to question that. There's no question. If you find it liberating, that's fine, but let us not, you know, gloss over the hijab issue. I personally, coming from a society where the hijab was worn, didn't think it should be worn, have fought against it, and as we've seen, as you were saying, the Afghani women do want to take it off. You know, and what is being done to the young Muslim girls here and in other parts of the world where they are being told from day one they must cover their head? What other repression that comes with it? You know, and this is just one sign of it. I don't think of it as liberating at all. If somebody wants to do it of their own choice at the age of 21 or 18, I could see it. But at the age of 5, 4, or 3, when they are going to these Muslim schools, that I have a great issue with.
Leila Awafi, you chose to wear, you said your sister does not wear a hijab.
Right. Well, because I chose to wear it, obviously I have thoroughly researched it, and I have thoroughly come to the conviction in the reasons behind wearing it. And I agree with my fellow panelists that, you know, perhaps making it mandatory for little schoolgirls to have to wear it may not necessarily be, you know, the right way to teach about hijab, although I've met many young girls who look up to their female role models that are, you know, wearing hijab and that are professional women that are, you know, leading their families, that are, you know, functioning very freely and choose to wear it, and they enjoy it, and they enjoy wearing it from a young age. I think that there are you know, values, and like I said, there's a spirit of modesty and a spirit of dignity, and that goes along with it. And I believe that covering my hair is private. It's, you know, there are certain parts of me that are reserved to my home and those that are closest to me, and I think that those values are very, I appreciate them, and I think that they're shared in many other traditional cultures. I mean, I was just speaking with a woman yesterday who's from the Dominican Republic, and we were talking about the hijab, and she said, you know what, we share a lot of those traditions from back home, and I understand it.
We've just been joined by Dr. Fawzia Afzal Khan, who is a professor at Montclair State University, author of Cultural Imperialism and the Indo-English Novel. Now, Rinaz Saeed Vafa just said she thinks that the sort of the discussion about the hijab can get obsessive when there's so many issues to discuss. What is your response to that?
I think she's right on that. And frankly, I'm kind of tired of the debate as though that were the only issue facing us. But in a way, it's been sort of brought on by the kind of obsessive attention, I think, that has been paid to it in recent decades, really pretty much after the Iranian Revolution, I think, was sort of the turning point around our becoming obsessed about the veil and what it signified, although the historically it goes back earlier, I would say, and I'm thinking particularly of the Algerian Revolution and what happened right after that. And so, I mean, my own take on the veil and the hijab is that it's a highly politicized movement. It had political valence. It has very little to do with my understanding of Islam, the religion of Islam. You know, if you want to go back historically, it's pre-Islamic. And yes, issues of modesty and all that notwithstanding, which are enjoined equally upon men and women if you read the Quran, the hijab as such is not mentioned. And so I think that the taking of the hijab was a signal and it was a sign by women in post-colonial or you know, societies that were becoming newly post-colonial, and it was a way to really assert their independence from these countries, Europe, European countries that had ruled their nations and had tried to impose their political, cultural values, you know, basically ramming them down their throats. And so it was a response to that. And it should be seen in that context. I think that what's happening now is that a lot of people, a lot of young women, think it's somehow about religion, but it's not. It's a political signature. It's a political sign. And I think it has crossed over. It's become dangerous. It has really made for very dangerous developments in the Muslim world. And often, not always, but often it really does signifying a shutting down of the mind. It means an accepting of a certain kind of oppressive tradition, which Islam does not, I believe, stand for. And so I'm really completely against the hijab.
We have to take a break. Dr. Fawzia Afzal Khan from Montclair University, Mirnaz Saeed Vafa on the phone with us, filmmaker, Leila Awafi, caseworker at Arab American Family Support Center in New York, and Zuvia Hamid, writer and medical doctor in the studio with us. You're listening to War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Shelter, I'll be your land, I'll be your everything, I'll be your friend, I'll be your water when you're thirsty and dry. I woke up morning in a crowded city, protected by grace. There were these hands, hundreds reaching for me. They knew exactly who and what I should be.
Be Your Water, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on the War and Peace Report as we broadcast just blocks from the first Ground Zero, the towers of the World Trade Center where they once stood. Afghanistan is the second. We're talking about feminism and fundamentalism, and we've been focusing on the hijab, the head covering that some Islamic women wear. In fact, women in a number of different religions wear some form of covering in that way. Our guests in the Firehouse studio, Leila Awafi, caseworker at Arab American Family Support Center in New York, Zuvia Hamid, a writer and medical doctor originally from Pakistan, Mirnaz Saeed Vafa, a filmmaker, professor at Film and Video Department, Columbia College in Chicago, made the film A Tajik Women, which we watched and heard on the program last week, and Dr. Fawzia Afzal Khan, professor at Montclair State University, author of Cultural Imperialism and the Indo-English Novel. Leila Awafi, you wanted to say something right after Dr. Afzal Khan was speaking.
Yes, I did. Well, first I'd like to just say that I really appreciate this sort of debate. I think that oftentimes, you know, in the traditions of Islam, we're, you know, told that we shouldn't, you know, really question authority and we shouldn't question the decisions. But in fact, in the religious texts, we are encouraged to think and to ponder and to ask questions and not to follow blindly. Like I said, in our faith, we are, you know, individually accountable, and therefore you do need to become, you need to come into your own choices, you know, aware of what sort of reasons you have behind them and what sort of consequences they have. And so for my fellow panelists to say that, you know, women that accept hijab do it, you know, and follow blindly into some sort of political statement, maybe that's true about some of them. There are many people that follow a lot of different trends blindly, but I don't think that that really encompasses the whole scheme of the women that wear hijab. And I do disagree on the technical points of its validity, religiously speaking. I think that since there is free access to the religious texts, I think that people do, you know, are allowed to go and examine them. Although, you know, in order to really fully understand complete meanings, you need to have some sort of comprehensive background and training and in linguistics and the Arabic language and just understanding the complete, you know, all of the religious texts. But, you know, I've done some of my own research, and I've come to the opposite conclusion of what my fellow panelists have, that it doesn't have a foundation in the actual religion, technically speaking. But like I said, it's beyond certain technical points, it is a spirit, and it is a general application of, like I said, modesty and self-respect, and it's a code of behavior. And how you dress definitely is a part of it, reflects, you know, your self concept.
Dr. Hamid.
Yeah, you know, I think that it's important to remember that there are lots of us who are not covering our heads, who are following the principle of Islam. I mean, I'm fasting. This is, inshallah, God willing, I'll be able to complete all my 30 fasts by Saturday or Sunday, and I can certainly do it without covering my head. I think that hijab, you know, the way Leila is practicing, she's American born, she is doing it out of her own choice, is somewhat understandable. But hijab is a double-edged sword. Whenever women, you know, and at this point, there are lots of agendas that are attached to it. In other parts of the world, it means certain things. As I was talking about, the Muslim schools in the United States where the little girls are wearing hijab do not have the same kind of sports facilities, are not being offered the same kind of education that their brethren, the boys, are being offered, is another issue. I think that it's very important to remember that I could understand what Fawzia was saying, that it has become politicized, but now it is getting out of control. Mm-hmm. And that is why it's important to address it. Even in the United States, my daughter, my oldest daughter, goes to a college, Brenner College, and, you know, they were going to have a Muslim Youth Day at Great Adventure, which is in New Jersey. And I coming from Pakistan and knowing what a gathering like that could mean, I told her to be careful, just be careful. She arrives there with some friends of hers, some of who were in hijab and some who were not. And there were gangs, not necessarily gangs, but, yeah, groups of men who approached them, not necessarily rudely, but very, very firmly, trying to convert them, and not only just convert them, but to bully them at that point and saying things like, well, come here, sisters, we want to tell you about Islam, because obviously you do not know enough about it, otherwise you would have your mm-hmm. head covered. This is when they're trying to ride roller coasters. So this is the other face of Islam, of hijab, which is very ugly, I think, and it's important to bring it out. And there's no need to cover it by saying, well, it's my choice and I'm doing it out of choice. Majority of the women, I think, are doing it because of cultural reasons. It has absolutely nothing. You know that in Egypt, the biggest debate that's going on is not the hijab. The biggest debate that is going on is female circumcision. For the longest, it is a cultural issue in a large part of Africa. In Egypt at this point, there are women who want it done. There are young girls who want it done because they feel that if they don't have it done, it's like they will not be what would be considered in America cool enough. You know, we have children, Fawzi and I, both teenagers. You know, there's some things they absolutely think that if they don't have it, they're going to die without it. This is what it has become. So the hijab has now, I mean, has many, many angles, but it is being used to suppress women. Indeed, it is. And the women can revolt against it, certainly in this part of the world. But to just to, you know, to give it this face of it's liberating and I don't feel like a sexual thing and all that, that's again nonsense too. Growing up in Peshawar where the hijab was very much part of the culture, let me tell you that there are desires that both young and men and women have. And at that time, the burqa that used to be popular was a black one, which was like a sort of like a cape. And it had like three little flimsy things attached. And those are the days of beehives. So women used to, you know, to sort of have the little beehive tied behind because you didn't want your hair crushed. You know, have a tremendous amount of eye makeup. Eye makeup is a very important part of Oriental custom. My daughters make fun of me. They say, even at this age, I don't want to give it up. You know, my entire being is tied to my eye makeup. And then you had to cross it across your face in such a fashion that only your eyes showed. And then so it was made into a very sexual thing. Hijab can be far more sexual, and those of us who were uncovered were far less alluring and far less exciting compared to, I mean, Fawzia's nodding her head. She's seen the way you wiggle in it and the way you fling it around. I mean, heck, you know, it's like the dance of the seven whales. So let's not talk about it being liberating and all that. I mean, you know, people do various things with their for their own personal reasons. I can see Fawzia wants to say something.
Fawzia Afzal.
Well, you know, I mean, I have to see that I really do agree with most of what Dr. Hamida said. But I want to, you know, really caution that we really do have to look at the contemporary history around the hijab. It is a contemporary phenomenon, which is to say that women all around, you know, the Muslim world, there were women like my grandmother, her generation, women before her, who dressed very modestly. Some of them chose to wear a head-to-toe covering, which was largely a class-based thing, by the way. And it was a lower middle-class thing, and primarily because the men felt that keeping their women in that parda was a sign that elevated their class status. I mean, this has been researched and studied, and everybody knows it. You know, that aspect about the veil, it must be brought out. It was a way of saying, you know, we're here, you know, upper class white women shielded themselves from the sun because, you know, they didn't have to then, you know, that became a status symbol. Now, for example, the status symbol is so you can have, you know, you can have a nice tan. That means you've got lots of leisure. So it was a very much a class phenomenon. Secondly, the veil was deployed, as I said, in these post-colonial revolutionary movements because it was a way, ultimately, for the men to talk about a nation state and declare really the nation, you know, within the nation state, what is the role of the women? The role of the women is to provide symbolic fodder for the nation state. Mm-hmm. And so taking on the veil was a way of symbolizing we are holding on to our values. This is our country. And you Western people who've done bad things here, which they had, you know, can just, you know, take a hike and walk and we will control our women. And the women sided with that because that was part of their contribution, I think, to the building of that nation state. I think if it's understood historically in that way, then much of this kind of, you know, idea that this is somehow associated with purity and religiosity can be debunked because ultimately what my interest is in looking at religion, any religion, as a way to increase our spirituality. I don't understand what taking the hijab or not taking the hijab has to do with your spiritual life. Why must we get bogged down in these rituals or, you know, who fasts or who doesn't? And in Pakistan, let me tell you, there are women who go into the bazaars who do not take the hijab. I mean, we've had countless incidents where men, strange men, have the nerve to walk up to these women, you know, slap them across if their arms are bare or, you know, give them another nudge and say, you know, cover your hair. You know, this is ridiculous. This has become a way for men to feel some sort of power, you know, go on a power trip and tell women how to behave.
Mirna Saeed Vafa.
Yes, I wish we had a 7-year-old or 5-year-old girl in the panel too. to ask, you know, how she feels to be told what to wear. I think that, you know, the current crisis that we have is that of an identity that, you know, we feel that it's robbed. But, you know, that identity, I think that, you know, is, although it's now felt as a cultural and political identity on the part of the so-called third world, and especially Middle East and Muslim countries. But, you know, I think there, for me, there is a spiritual identity that is being, you know, at stake. And the conflict for me is has always been the idea of male control through religion and the spirituality of women. And I think what is really important is that, you know, that hijab that, you know, either we choose to wear or it's imposed on us, if it's a symbol of certain deprivation, as the other speaker mentioned. If, you know, by wearing it, you know, that's we are declaring that, you know, or we understood that our womanhood comes with hijab at the age of 5 or even earlier, and that, you know, we are deprived of certain sport, we are deprived of education, we are deprived of socialization, we are deprived of so on. That's a sign of repression. But, you know, that, you know, if it comes with, you know, if it symbolizes, I mean, it comes with that kind of, you know, deprivation, which is happening, you know, we cannot really close our eyes to see that, you know, it is happening. And to me, you can have a hijab, but not have an interior hijab, which is that, you know, level of modesty and, you know, the spirituality inside. So it could be very superficial, too, you know. So by, you know, imposing it, you can, you know, just make a whole generation of youth that would, you know, wear it, but in deep inside, they don't believe it. You know, they just wear it so that to save their lives, but they really don't believe it. Is that what we can, you know, is that, you know, the... what we really want to do, what we want to achieve, you know what I'm saying? You know, these are, you know, the question that is happening right now in many societies that, you know, enforce hijab on, you know, young women. And, you know, these days, you know, you cannot really do that. And, you know, control, you know, the issue of control of men over, you know, women has to be challenged, and not in the name of religion and spirituality.
Leila El-Wafi.
Right. Well, I'd really just like to come back to my own personal example. I just want to say that I believe that I'm an example of a woman who was raised in a society that had, I've had complete choice to make my own decisions. I've had complete access to religious teachings, to different religious teachings, not just, you know, I haven't just been indoctrinated in the Islamic texts. I have been offered other, you know, backgrounds, and I've been schooled in public school systems and in a private college system. I've had interactions with people from different faiths and different backgrounds. I have been offered the respect of my family, and I've been given the opportunity to achieve higher education and to make my own choices. And I think that this, in my decision to wear hijab, you know, I disagree with some of my panelists who say that it hasn't enhanced their spiritual life. It has enhanced mine, and it has enhanced my life in many ways. I believe, in fact, it's probably one of the best decisions I've made in my life. And so I really think coming at it from this approach where, you know, it is sort of neutralized from these major political and major statements that, you know, like my fellow panelists have said, have often occurred in a historical context. Just to kind of break it down to its what it essentially is, I think that for women to be offered the freedom and the choice and the religious education behind why, and to come to their own decision to wear it, I believe is ultimately the best way. And I don't think that you know, it's oppressive, and many things, there are many tools used to oppress women, and I think it would behoove us to examine many ways in America how women are, you know, oppressed. I don't think that it's just limited to Muslim schools where girls are given lesser facilities. I think that their Title IX was recently passed by the government to allow girls in public schools, in American Judeo-Christian
public
schools.
Well, on that note, I'm
going
to have
facilities.
To break this conversation off because we have come to the end of the program.
Thank you. I think
what all of our panelists do agree on is the issue of choice, women having the freedom to choose. I want to thank you all, Leila Wafi, Zufia Hamid, Mirna Said Vafa, and Dr. Fawzia Afzal Khan. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner and Saganya Mahendra. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. We're broadcasting at Downtown Community Television in New York, in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how. would feel to be free.
From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
This is Carol Spooner. Today, we actually put on record a settlement agreement that achieves more than we could ever have achieved at trial, that gives us an opportunity to restore Pacifica to its mission.
Pacifica board members and litigants sign a legally binding settlement. In Afghanistan, as U.S. British troops move into Kandahar, we'll talk to a reporter about the fighting among anti-Taliban forces. Authorities arrest leaders of the Jewish Defense League for a plot to bomb one of Los Angeles's largest mosques. And an arsonist starts a fire in the Chicago offices of the Arab American Action Network. We'll speak with Ali Abu Nima, as well as a reporter from The New Yorker, Hedrick Hertzberg. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. planes began blasting the mountain hideouts of trapped al-Qaeda fighters after the expiration of a surrender or die ultimatum from the U.S.-backed Afghan forces besieging them. Al-Qaeda forces had previously said they would only surrender in the presence of U.N. troops and diplomats from their own countries to prevent them from being massacred by U.S.-backed mujahideen, as they had been in the northern part of the country. Amidst the bombing, the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden are still unknown. According to conflicting newspaper reports, he has both fled to neighboring Pakistan and remains in the Tora Bora Mountains, where his forces are holed up. With a final push against bin Laden's forces likely, UN Security Council members are negotiating a resolution that would authorize a multinational peacekeeping force for Afghanistan. Britain, which will lead the force, is scrambling to get a contingent of troops from mainly NATO nations into Afghanistan by December 22nd, when the new interim government is to take office. British and U.S. Special Forces, along with CIA operatives, began a visible presence in Kandahar yesterday after staffing checkpoints outside the city to search for al-Qaeda fighters and senior Taliban members. The patrols began despite a U.S. Forces spokesperson at the American Marine base at Camp Rhino, southern Afghanistan, saying they'd no intention of entering the city. A B-1 bomber crashed into the Indian Ocean yesterday after its engines failed 30 miles north of the British airbase at Diego Garcia. All four crew members were rescued. It was the first loss of a fixed-wing aircraft in the conflict. The B-1 had been taking part in the same bombing missions in Afghanistan as B-52 and B-2 bombers. Government officials have acknowledged that for nearly a decade, U.S. Army scientists at Dugway Proving Ground in Utah have made weapons-grade anthrax that's virtually identical to the powdery spores used in recent mail attacks that have killed 5 people. Until the anthrax attacks led to tighter security measures, anthrax grown at Dugway was regularly sent by Federal Express to the Army's Biodefense Center at Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland, where the bacteria were killed using gamma radiation before being returned to Dugway for experiments. Dugway's production of weapons-grade anthrax, which has never before been publicly revealed, is apparently the first by the U.S. government since President Nixon ordered the U.S. Offensive Biowarfare Program closed in 1969. 10 Israelis were killed, up to 30 wounded, many critically, when Palestinian gunmen ambushed their bus as it was passing the ultra-Orthodox Jewish settlement of Emmanuel near Nablus in the West Bank. The killings immediately triggered a wave of bombing raids by Israeli warplanes. Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority, facing massive international pressure to clamp down on militants, immediately ordered the closure of all offices of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, the groups that have claimed responsibility for a wave of recent attacks. But in a decision with ominous implications, Israel's cabinet last night voted to sever ties with Yasser Arafat and to launch wide-scale military operations against cities in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
In related news, some 60 Israelis who federal investigators have said are part of a long-running effort to spy on U.S. government officials are among the hundreds of foreigners detained since the September 11th attacks. The Israelis, a handful of whom are described as active Israeli military or intelligence operatives, have been detained on immigration charges or under the new Patriot anti-terrorism law. There's no indication the Israelis were involved in the September 11th attacks, but investigators suspect they may have gathered intelligence about the attacks in advance and not shared it. The chair and leading member of the Jewish Defense League was charged yesterday in a bombing plot aimed at the office of an Arab American congressman and a prominent Los Angeles mosque. JDL Chair Irv Rubin and Earl Krugel were held without bail after being arrested Tuesday after explosive powder was delivered to Krugel's home by a longtime JDL member who turned federal informant. Other bomb components and weapons were seized in Krugel's home. Authorities said the two men held a series of meetings in October to plan the bombing of the King Fahd Mosque and the San Clemente office of freshman Republican Congressmember Daryl Issa. Half a dozen armed men stormed India's sprawling parliament building today, leaving at least 13 dead in a more than half-hour shootout. Parliament was adjourned at the time of the attack, but most lawmakers were still inside. The killings are being called the worst breach of government security since the assassination of Prime Minister Indira Gandhi in 1984. New Delhi's police chief said six police officers and an army commando and all six of the gunmen were killed in the attack, whose cause is still unknown. Congressional lawmakers hammered Enron's corporate auditor in hearings on Capitol Hill yesterday, charging that executives of the now bankrupt energy giant enriched themselves through illegal insider trading and slick financial gimmicks while running the energy trading company into the ground. Enron chair Kenneth Lay, key Bush ally, refused an invitation to appear before the committee.
Stop the war now!
Good God, hear me sing!
Don't put it off!
Another day, everybody says,
stop the war.
Nah, 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 nah.
Don't put it off.
Another day, all we got to do is listen.
There'll be some chance.
Oh, oh, oh. Don't throw another life away. Listen to me now. Think about all the soldiers that are dead and gone today. If you ask them to fight again, what do you think they'd say?
Stop the war now. Edwin Starr here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. British and U.S. Special Forces, along with CIA operatives, entered Kandahar yesterday after staffing checkpoints outside the city to search for al-Qaeda fighters and senior Taliban members. The patrols began in spite of claims by U.S. Forces spokesmen at the U.S. Marine base at Camp Rhino, southern Afghanistan, that they'd no intention of entering the city. Under an agreement reached about a week ago, Kandahar will be run by Gul Aga, who was deposed as governor of the city when the Taliban seized control in 1994. But since the fall of the Taliban in Kandahar, competing anti-Taliban forces have been fighting each other for control, raising fears that it could plunge into the sort of devastating civil conflict that left tens of thousands dead in the mid-1990s. We're going to go now to Kandahar, to Peter Beaumont, reporter for the London Guardian. He is speaking to us by satellite phone, so you have to listen very carefully. While the phone line is difficult, we thought it was well worth getting into Afghanistan for this information. I started by asking him what's happening in the city right now.
You know, at the moment, the city's reasonably quiet. We've seen U.S. Special Forces and British Special Forces patrolling with local anti-Taliban militias today. There's been some gunfire tonight, but we don't know what it's about. There's been some tension between some of the groups in the city, but nothing terribly serious. Essentially, people have just been looking around to see what's been going on, and been mainly to see Mullah Omar's house on the outskirts of the city.
You can see the house?
Yeah, we visited the house. It's a massive compound, about 4 or 5 kilometers from the city center.
And what exactly do you see?
Well, as you leave the city, you come on this plantation of pine trees. And as you go through it, it screens the city, it screens the compound from the city. And as you emerge, you reach a checkpoint, and suddenly you're by this rock ridge with a saddle coming down onto the plain, and there is this enormous compound about the size of 6 soccer fields, surrounded on all sides by a 15-foot wall, and inside just a complex of buildings, some of them quite badly destroyed.
Where is it believed Mohammed Omar is right now?
Well, we've heard from the governor, Gulaga Shahzai. He believes he's hiding with some of the diehard Taliban between Kandahar and Helmand province. And clearly the U.S. and British Special Forces are looking for him at the moment, and there's a lot of them about.
What about the reports of the fighting between Mujahideen Northern Alliance forces?
Well, the Northern Alliance aren't here. It's the forces that you're talking about, the former governor, Gulaga, who's again governor here, and forces loyal to a guy called Mullah Nakibullah, who's quite close to the Taliban and to whom the Taliban surrendered. But in the last few days, there's been a tribal council here at the governor's mansion, and the interim prime minister and the council have confirmed Gulaga as the man in charge of the city. And when we came down yesterday, his troops were clearly in charge of the road. Perhaps the shooting we've heard tonight is some continuing skirmishing between the two groups, or it may simply be looting. We're not going outside to find out.
Who actually is in control of Kandahar right now?
Gulaga Shahzai seems to be very largely in control. Hamid Karzai was at the Omar's old compound today with some of his bodyguard, but it seems clear that, you know, Gulaga is the man who's running the place. He's sitting in the governor's mansion. Everywhere you go in the town, his troops are patrolling. And, you know, 3 days ago we were hearing on the other side of the border that there are 15 checkpoints and 4 different factions controlling the road. But when we came down yesterday, there were 3 checkpoints, and the security on the road was entirely controlled by Gulaga. And as far as the city and the main road goes, he's in charge. It may be that there are other people further out, but so far we haven't encountered them yet.
Can you explain further who Gulaga is, one of the men who would not back the Bonn Accord?
Gulaga was the former governor up till 1994, when it was very fierce interfactional fighting in Kandahar. When the fighting and abuses were so serious, actually the population of the city welcomed the Taliban in. Because people still speak of the Taliban as bringing a period of peace to Kandahar. Because what was going on before, there was robbery, rape, intimidation, murder. There's these different groups fought for control of the city. Now, in that period, Gulaga was one of the people who was controlling part of the city. He came across at the end of last week from Pakistan with a group of his men. He seems now to have a large number of men in the city, and at the moment he seems to be having things in control, and he seems to have the backing of Hamid Karzai, the interim prime minister, seems to have his backing as well.
And what about Rashid Dostin, the Uzbeki general?
He's a long way to the north. He's an awfully long way north. He's 25 hours from here.
The people in the
country up there.
Are there just civilians who are walking around in Kandahar?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the bazaar opened here again for the first time properly on Saturday. All the shops are open. There are people on the street. You can see women going shopping now, although still dressed in the full burqa. But, I mean, women are walking on the streets now with their children. There are an awful lot of people out there. There are people working in their kind of machine shops, selling everything from biscuits to motorbikes.
And their reaction to the U.S. bombing?
It's mixed, but on the whole, there is a sort of, from the people we've spoken to so far, and perhaps because they're the people who are speaking to us, there is a sense of relief. And even ex-Taliban people that we've spoken to have said that as long as the Americans are here and the British are here, you know, to make peace, then they're happy with it. As long as they go away afterwards, you know, when the government is in control.
What about?
So we came here thinking it would be very hostile, because on the other side of the border in Pakistan, in the Afghan refugee camps, it's very, very hostile indeed. But so far, we haven't experienced any hostility. But I say so far.
What about word of Osama bin Laden and where he is in relation to where you are in Kandahar?
I'll be completely honest. I don't think anyone has the slightest clue. I mean, there seems to be some theory that he's in Tora Bora. He may well be there, but I really don't think anyone knows.
And how far is Tora Bora from you?
We're in the south. We're about sort of 80 miles from the southern Pakistan border. Tora Bora is over by Jalalabad, which, if you think, you go straight up from the south and then turn right. So it's quite some time from here, quite some way, quite a way.
You were in London reporting on the so-called war on terrorism. Now you're in Kandahar. For you, how has it changed your perspective?
The only difference in perspective is that you actually see the people on the ground. You actually see the people who've been sort of living under the bombing for the last few months. It simply coalesces your idea of the people involved. I think that's it, really. I mean, I've covered, you know, a number of conflicts, and but actually to see the people and see how they're living and hear their stories, I think that's much, much stronger. Mm-hmm. It gives you a real sense of what was going on.
Finally, we talked...
A sense of who the victims are, in a way, and the victims are the Afghan people, ordinary people.
You're just in Kandahar right now, but you've written about the U.S.'s secret plans to extend the so-called war on terrorism to Iraq. Can you talk about that as well?
Sure. I mean, it's simply what we've heard. Our correspondents, both in the States and in London, have done some work on this. And it's obviously been written about a lot in the States as well. But, I mean, clearly there is some contingency planning to extend it. I mean, whether the political decision's been made or not, what we've heard from sources in London, you know, military sources and sources in the United States, who are very good sources, is that clearly, you know, there is a plan in the air and there are a group of people around Deputy Defense Secretary and others who would be quite keen to see this. I mean, personally, I haven't seen any evidence that convinces me that there is a link, but some of my colleagues seem to believe that there is.
We're talking to Peter Beaumont of The Guardian newspaper in Britain. He's in Kandahar right now. We're speaking to him on a cell phone. Peter Beaumont, on Monday, we had an exclusive with a professor who, from the first day of the bombing, has been analyzing the number of casualties, cross-referencing newspaper reports and other reports around the world 14 hours a day. His figures range from 3,700 to 5,000. Does that seem reasonable to you? And also, do you see people dead in the streets?
I think it's going to be at the low end of the scale. I mean, Kandahar has been one of the most bombed cities in this conflict. And I have to say, I mean, one of the things that was absolutely extraordinary visiting the compound was the way in which the bombs had... It was almost as if it was absolute precision bombing. They'd hit all the guards' buildings all around the living quarters, but the living quarters were largely intact. And when you look around the city, I mean... It's mainly government buildings that have been hit and vehicles that you see on the road. And most of the vehicles we've seen destroyed on the road are things like tankers, tanks, pickups surrounded by the remains of rocket-propelled grenades. They seem to have been hitting the right thing. So far, we haven't been here very long, but so far we haven't seen any civilian areas that have been hit, although we may see that tomorrow when we have a chance to travel more on the city.
We've been speaking with Peter Beaumont, who is in Kandahar right now, speaking to us by satellite phone. Peter Beaumont is with The Guardian newspaper in Britain. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll talk about the humanitarian crisis of Afghan refugees. Then we'll go to the historic Pacifica Agreement, what it could mean on the ground with all the lawsuits dropped at the oldest independent media network in this country. We're then going to have a discussion between the Arab-American media analyst Ali Abu Nima, whose own offices in Chicago were set afire by an arsonist, and Hedrick Hertzberg of The New Yorker magazine. Back in a minute.
They say every man needs protection. They say every man must fall. Somewhere inside these walls.
shall be released. Nina Simone, here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. A potential humanitarian disaster is unfolding in Afghanistan's largest refugee camp as new arrivals from outlying villages pour daily into a camp already filled with more than 200,000 refugees. At least 10,000 people have arrived at the Maslak camp in the last 2 weeks from outlying villages. This, according to the International Organization for Migration, which supervises it. The latest arrivals have strained the camp's limited resources and increased the risk of disease, hunger, and exposure to the cold. A refugee worker said there are many more thousands coming and that the camp is in an emergency. Meanwhile, earlier this week, the United Nations accused Iran and U.S. ally Pakistan of forcibly repatriating Afghan refugees in violation of international law. UN officials believe several thousand people have been pushed across the border near the city of Herat. We're joined right now by Sarah Zaidi, who has just returned from refugee camps in Pakistan, shocked to discover that Pakistan does not give Afghan refugees official refugee status and regularly deports them. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you, Amy.
Sarah Zaidi is with the Center for Economic and Social Rights. Where were you exactly?
I was actually in Peshawar and Islamabad, mostly in Peshawar, looking at the refugee camps and meeting with Afghan groups there who are trying to assist the refugees. Went up to the border for a little bit, the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. I was just there for about 10 days looking at the situation.
I think it is very surprising to hear that Afghan refugees are being sent back. Where are they being sent?
They're actually being sent back into Afghanistan. That's where, since last year, end of last year, November, December, most countries surrounding Afghanistan have officially closed their borders. Therefore, any refugee, regardless of how they cross over, is not given refugee status, direct violation of the 1951 Refugee Convention. They are considered illegal immigrants, or in the terms of UNHCR, are referred to as invisible refugees or externally displaced persons. In Pakistan, there are close to about 200,000 new arrivals since all of this has happened, since September, who are basically either going to the old refugee camps or actually are encamped in parts of Peshawar where there is just, you know, like squatter settlements. They have, they've come with basically nothing, and they have nothing. They're in makeshift shelters. I mean, I wouldn't even want to call them tents because they are really makeshift shelters. Real shortage of water, no shoes. And the temperatures are dropping. I mean, their children are, I saw quite a few cases of malnutrition in the camps. They're supposed to be relocated into the federally administered territories where UNHCR has been allowed to set up camps, actual refugee camps. However, these people will still not be given refugee status yet. They can go to these camps. They're about 5 hours away from Peshawar. And can actually get assistance, food assistance, and, you know, tents, etc. However, those areas are very dangerous, and as we just heard, and it's possible that Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden or, you know, those areas, those people could be there. They're extremely sympathetic to the Taliban. So most of these refugees who are from the northern part of Afghanistan don't feel safe, and neither do, for instance, any of the humanitarian workers who are foreigners. So even though since November 28th, a few thousand have been relocated to these refugee camps, I'm not sure if the 200,000 will eventually be relocated. Most likely, given the peace settlement, they'll be forced back into Afghanistan, where most of them who I spoke with have lost everything. You know, their houses have been destroyed, their fields have been destroyed, the bombing has really, you know, they have nothing left. Oh, so this is a situation in Pakistan. Now, if you just look over on the other side of the border, there's a lot of internally displaced persons, about 1 million people that are, as you just heard, on coming to refugee camps. And there's no way that any UNHCR or anyone can meet the needs of these people.
You know, it's why an independent network in this country is so important to get word out, and also critical are the teach-ins, the discussion groups that are being held around the country below the corporate media radar, where the media just doesn't cover the peace movement in this country. But you're going to be part of one of these teach-ins on Saturday night.
Saturday night, which may be the last day of the fast for Eid. We are organizing
Ramadan.
We're organizing a teach-in in New York City, and information can be gotten about the event from our website at the Center for Economic and Social Rights. It's www.cesr.org. There's going to be a panel discussion, and then there are going to be performance by Afghan musicians and poets, and there will be Afghan food, and the proceeds will be going for the Afghan refugees.
And for those listeners who are in the New York area, it's at Grace Church in Brooklyn Heights. Your website at the Council for the Center for Economic and Social Rights?
It's www.cesr.org.
I want to thank you very much
for
being with us. Yes, how important it is to have independent media in this country, and that's what we're going to talk about next. A historic agreement was reached yesterday between all plaintiffs in four lawsuits against the Pacifica Radio Network and the Pacifica Foundation's Board of Directors. The agreement returns official control of the Pacifica Network, the nation's oldest public broadcaster, to community radio advocates. Yesterday's settlement calls for an interim board controlled by the current minority to serve for 15 months while new democratic structures are implemented for an elected national Pacifica board. The agreement brings to an end 2.5 years of legal, political, and community struggle following an illegal change in the method of selecting Pacifica's directors, who had traditionally been elected by the local station boards. Many have felt that the changes took place to moderate the programming at Pacifica. In the last 2.5 years, Pacifica has banned and fired dozens of broadcasters, incurred millions of dollars in expenditures due to high fees paid to corporate attorneys, public relations companies, and security firms. Pacifica's finances have not been disclosed to either board members or donors in over a year, but at the last board meeting in Washington in November, it was reported that the foundation, a $10.8 million foundation, may be close to $4 million in debt. The settlement comes just a day after it became public that the number two person in the network, the national program director, Utrice Lead, had resigned her post after only 2 months on the job. She had been elevated before that to WBAI general manager almost a year ago, after she helped carry out last December's so-called Christmas coup at WBAI. Senior Pacifica management changed the locks in the middle of the night, installed security guards and cameras, and then over the next months fired or banned more than two dozen producers and staff. According to recently released Arbitron estimates, nearly 1 year after these dramatic management changes and mass firings and bannings at Pacifica, the network's audience figures have dropped sharply. At WBAI in New York, at KPFT in Houston, it's believed between 30% and 40% drop-off of listeners. We're going to go right now to Pacifica Station, KPFA in Berkeley, where yesterday afternoon the settlement was announced by a number of the plaintiffs who went to the airwaves. The discussion was then rebroadcast on Flashpoints with Noel Hanrahan. We're going to KPFA.
My name is Noel Hanrahan, and you're listening to Flashpoints on KPFA. This is Pacifica Watch. The litigants who've been battling to save the last independent radio network in the country, Pacifica, and return our venerable six-station network to its historic mission have reached an agreement settling the lawsuit, seating a new interim board of the Pacifica Foundation, and beginning the work of returning the network to its mission to be an alternative voice of peace with justice. We now go to the voices of Carol Spooner, plaintiff in the listener lawsuit, Robbie Osmond, host of Across the Great Divide on KPFA, and Dave Adelson, chair of the KPFK Advisory Board and plaintiff in the local advisory board lawsuit. They came to KPFA's studios directly from the Alameda County Courthouse.
Hi, this is Carol Spooner. Today, we actually put on record a settlement agreement that achieves more than we could ever have achieved at trial, that gives us an opportunity to restore Pacifica to its mission. I am absolutely overjoyed, as a matter of fact. We achieved more than I ever thought we could do without trial. We do have control of the board of directors. We do have wonderful, vibrant people who will be on this board committed to working hard over the next 15 months as an interim board to solve the problems that have been created. And just thank you to Sherry and to Dan Siegel and to all the lawyers and Robbie and Barbara, friends of Free Speech Radio, who have helped us through this long struggle. It has been a privilege and an honor to serve.
Robbie Osman, who, as many of you know, is the host of Across the Great Divide, a longtime volunteer at KPFA.
Yeah, we should lay out for folks exactly what this settlement looks like so we know where it is and what's real here. There will be 15 people on a board, five of them selected by the people who had been the majority of the board. Five of them selected by the people who have been the dissidents of the board, and five selected by the chairs of the LABs, by the chairs of the presently existing local advisory boards. Of those five, that last group, we expect four to be clearly progressive people, and one coming from a Houston board that we haven't been very close to, not necessarily so. That makes nine to six in our favor, and that's a powerful margin. Decisions will be made in one of the following ways. Either we will get two-thirds of the people voting in present, or we will get a majority of the people voting in present that includes one person from each of those three groups, or we will get a simple majority that's approved by the judge. Our expectation is that the judge will not stand in the way of a reasonable decision by the majority, and will not be inclined to stand in the way of reasonable decisions of the majority. So we think that the good guys control the board, and we can just begin to start moving towards thinking about what Pacifica needs to be, what Pacifica ought to be, and where we need to go.
Hi, my name's Dave Adelson, and people are pointing at me, so I assume that means they want me to talk to you. I'm chair of the KPFK Local Advisory Board in Los Angeles and was one of the people involved in the Local Advisory Board lawsuit. I just want to say that I see this as a very positive opening. 3 years ago, when people were within the institution were behaving in very high-handed manner, removing people, ignoring complaints, ignoring the communities, and perpetrating all manner of assaults on what I understood to be the mission, I never thought that we would see this day. And I'm very grateful to everybody out there who participated in it. I want to say that this will constitute a win when you, who are listening, are able to make demands on the station and not be told politely to go away or not be ignored, but this acts as your radio station. So please stay involved. We'll need you.
And that was the voice of Dave Adelson, chair of the KPFK Local Advisory Board. And we're joined in the studio now by Carol Spooner, plaintiff in the listener's lawsuit, Leslie Kagan, dissident Pacifica Foundation National Board member, Barbara Lubin, plaintiff and member of Friends of Free Speech Radio, and Matthew Lazar, a historian of Pacifica and former KPFA news guy. So, Leslie, I'd like to start with you and your reactions to today's announcement.
Well, I want to start by saying that you just called me the dissident board member. I think actually that's changed. I'm now a majority board member. I am, aside from being totally exhausted by this whole process and wondering where I and all the rest of us are going to get the energy to do all the work ahead of us, but putting that aside for a moment, I am quite profoundly happy. I don't think, by no stretch of the imagination have we won everything. What we've done is opened up a door. We took advantage of a little crack that was open, and we opened the door way big, way wide. And now we And by we, I don't just mean the interim board that's being put together, but I mean the family, the community of Pacifica, all around the country. Now we all have to walk through that door with as much clarity and commitment and dedication to the tasks that we have ahead of us. So what happened today, it shifted the terrain so that now we can begin the rebuilding process. And that's good news. That's good news for all of us.
Now, Matthew Lazar, tell us what was at stake in terms of Pacifica's mission.
I believe that this settlement and the excellent work which these people have done, congratulations to you. You are my heroes. Quite literally delivers this organization from the gates of hell. For the first time in, I would say, almost 3 years, I can go to bed tonight sure and confident that I will not wake up tomorrow morning or the day after that or the day after that and find out from the grapevine that one of the Pacifica stations is actually being put up for sale, that the organization isn't about to be dismantled and integrated into the extant public corporate broadcasting network. I feel for the first time in a very long time that the organization is safe in a fundamental sense from that fate. And for that reason alone, it's really, really terribly important. It's also important because at the same time that the organization is now going to work on this settlement, the external situation is once again getting very, very hot. I mean, we have an attorney general right now who says that criticism of him or his policies are essentially treasonous, and who wants to open up the FBI to allowing investigation of political and religious organizations again. And, of course, if those things happen, who is the national security state going to go after first? It's going to go after the Pacifica Radio Network. So having a national board that is sympathetic to the mission of the organization, I think, is very important at this particular time. I'm very, very relieved that this has happened.
Matthew Lazar, historian of Pacifica, former KPFA newsperson, Leslie Kagan, dissident Pacifica board member, now in the majority, Dave Adelson, chair of the Pacifica Station KPFK Local Advisory Board, plaintiff in the Local Advisory Board lawsuit, Robbie Osman, host of Across the Divide at KPFA, Carol Spooner, the lead plaintiff in the listener lawsuit against Pacifica, all in the studios of Pacifica Station KPFA yesterday, announcing the settlement of the four lawsuits against the Pacifica Foundation. Now, top among the hot issues that the new Pacifica board say that they will address in their first days are the resolution of the banning and the firing of the producers at WBAI and other stations, the return of those producers, as well as resolution of the stringer strike against the Pacifica Network News. For more than a year, journalists have struck against PNN, among other issues, over censorship. And we will continue to talk about these historic developments in our more than 50-year-old network, founded by Lou Hill, in Berkeley, California, KPFA, 1949, a man who had just come out of detention camp for refusing to fight in World War II and said there has to be a media outlet in this country that's not run by corporations who beat a drum for war, but by journalists and artists. And so Pacifica was born, the only independent media network in this country. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll have a discussion about the Middle East with New Yorker reporter Hedrick Hertzberg and media analyst Ali Abu Nima. Stay with us.
There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis the song, the sigh of the hard times come again no more. Many days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times come again no more. While we seek mirth and beauty and music, light and game, there are frail forms fainting by the door. Though their voices hearts are silent, their pleading looks will say, oh, hard times come again no more.
Hard times come again no more. James Taylor, Yo-Yo Ma, Edgar Meyer, and Mark O'Connor here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. 10 Israelis were killed and up to 30 wounded, many critically, when Palestinian gunmen ambushed their bus as it was passing the ultra-Orthodox Jewish settlement of Emmanuel near Nablus in the West Bank. The killings immediately triggered a wave of bombing raids by Israeli warplanes, and Israel's cabinet last night voted to sever ties with Yasser Arafat. Meanwhile, in the U.S., two leaders of the militant Jewish Defense League were arrested last night. Authorities charged they were assembling bombs to attack one of Los Angeles's largest mosques and the local offices of an Arab American congressman. And the offices of the Arab American Action Network and the Arab Community Center in Chicago were set on fire last week. Police ruled the fire was started by an arsonist, but have no leads or suspects. Today, we're going to have a discussion about violence in the Middle East and U.S. media coverage of it. But before we do that, Ali Abu Niba, can you tell us about your offices in Chicago, the Arab American Action Network, and what happened?
Well, there was a fire on December 5th, which the police ruled to be arson. It destroyed or severely damaged part of the building. It's a two-story building on the southwest side of Chicago that has served as a community center for the Arab community for more than 25 years. But there is no motivation as to no known motive as to the arson, and we're not treating it as a hate crime currently because there's just no evidence, and there has to be evidence for that. And we don't want to panic people unnecessarily. But it does come at a very hard time for us because we are having to do more work than ever, given the general climate facing Arab Americans in the country.
Ali Abu Niba, can you talk about what is happening not only here, but in the Middle East? A longtime critic you are of media coverage in the Middle East.
Yeah, well, what's happening is that Palestinians and Israelis are trying to kill each other, civilians, as much as possible. Palestinians set off bombs. Israel sets off bombs and shells and bombs refugee camps. And they have both really embraced the tactic of killing each other's civilians. I know that there are many people on the Palestinian side who try to justify some of these attacks on Israeli civilians. And there are many Israel supporters who try to justify attacks on Palestinian civilians and claim that it's in self-defense or that it's accidental and that there's somehow some moral justification for it when Israel does it. But the fact is Israel is using violence in furtherance of a military occupation in order to assure its settlers the ability to colonize occupied Palestinian land and to suppress any resistance to that. Palestinians, meanwhile, are unwilling to live under this occupation, and as long as the occupation exists, some of them will resist using illegitimate means. What it boils down to is that neither side can get out of this. The only way is through international intervention, particularly the United States, which without which Israel could not continue the occupation. U.S. military and financial intervention on Israel's side is what is allowing Israel to maintain the occupation. And until the U.S. Government is willing to take the domestic political risks and spend the domestic political capital to face down the yet intransigent Israeli lobby in this country, most of which has firmly declared its support for Sharon's approach, then we're going to see more Israeli civilians killed and more Palestinian civilians killed, and this is going to go on and only worsen.
Ali Abu Niba is vice president of the Arab American Action Network in Chicago. He is has a piece in a new book by Verso Press called The New Intifada, Resisting Israel's Apartheid. He wrote a piece recently in the New York Times, an op-ed piece, that Hendrik Hertzberg, the senior editor of New Yorker magazine, took issue with. He joins us on the line right now. Ali Abu Nima talked about the targeting and killing of innocent civilians, regardless of whether they're Israelis or Palestinians. Your thoughts on that, Rick Hertzberg?
Well, I thought that this sort of even-handed sounding formulation obscures something important, something that a distinction that ought to be maintained, and that is a distinction between it's a rather cold-blooded to say this, I suppose, but there is a distinction between targeting and killing civilians. And I don't think that what Hamas and Islamic Jihad do is targeting civilians. That is the strategy there. That is quite openly the strategy that they're pursuing. Israel does kill civilians, and that's bad enough. That's terrible. But it doesn't target them. Israel would prefer not to kill civilians.
Ali Abu Nima.
Well, I think Mr. Hertzberg is a perfect example of what I'm talking about, and he's simply ignoring the overwhelming mountain of evidence that has come from every single human rights group that has examined Israel's practices. And I'll point to one in particular, which is absolutely consistent with all the others, and this is Physicians for Human Rights USA, which sent a number of investigators over to look at the situation, and they concluded in the first few months of the Intifada, quote, I'm quoting from a report from November 22, 2000, that the pattern of injuries seen in many victims did not reflect IDF, that's Israel Defense Forces, use of firearms in life-threatening situations, but rather indicated targeting solely for the purpose of wounding or killing. And this finding was based on what they said was the totality of evidence they collected about the high number of gunshot wounds to the chest and the head, which indicated that Israeli forces deliberately target Palestinian civilians, unarmed civilians, which is how it happens to be that nearly 800 unarmed civilians, 200 of them children, have been killed. Those findings are absolutely consistent with Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the UN Security Council, even the State Department and its country reports on human rights practices for 2000. And that's everyone knows that's a highly politicized document issued by the U.S., which is the most pro-Israel government on earth, says that members of the Israeli security forces committed numerous serious human rights abuses, particularly following the outbreak of the Intifada. The Israeli human rights group, in addition to confirming and condemning all of this, has repeatedly protested the targeting of civilians in a number of ways. For example, the routine torture of Palestinian children at the Israeli police station in the settlement of Gush Etzion in the occupied West Bank. Furthermore, they have repeatedly condemned the fact that the Israeli authorities refused to investigate and punish incidents of willful and deliberate killing of Palestinian civilians by their soldiers and settlers. And despite this, in addition to this, there is a set of policies deliberately targeted to starve, intimidate, and terrify civilians. Gaza City was bombed last night for 5 hours by F-16s. F-16s designed to defend Israel against a foreign army, not against civilians living in refugee camps. Despite all of this, Mr. Hertzberg wants us to believe that the killing of Palestinians by Israel is morally superior to the killing of Israelis by Palestinians, which leads me to believe that he must value Israeli lives more than he values Palestinian lives. And I think that's unconscionable.
Hendrik Hertzberg of The New Yorker.
Are you suggesting that there's no distinction between, or do you see any distinction between a suicide bomb that kills 20 or 25 people in a square full of
cafe goers, and the kind of thing you're talking about. Do you see no distinction at all?
There's a distinction in method, but I think when heavily armed soldiers shoot dead 11-year-old boys, I don't see a distinction. I think it's morally repugnant on both sides, and I find it surprising that you think it's okay that soldiers, armed and paid for by the United States, are allowed to shoot dead 11-year-old boys with absolutely no consequences, and that you think that doing that in furtherance of a belligerent military occupation is justified self-defense and is not morally repugnant, and that you think it's accidental, given the fact that this has been documented as a deliberate and consistent pattern by numerous human rights groups. Furthermore, I don't see a distinction when Israel fires rockets into the middle of residential neighborhoods, killing children routinely, with the knowledge that that's going to happen. I find it just as repugnant. I value Israeli lives just as much as I value Palestinian lives, and I find it unfortunate that you don't. There's a difference in the method. There's a difference. Israel doesn't need to use suicide bombers. It has F-16s. But I find it absolutely repugnant that Israel is trying to maintain a belligerent military occupation and the colonization of this land, all in violation of international law, through the massive repression of human rights, willful and deliberate killing of civilians, and the routine use of torture. And the fact that you justify and defend this really ought to give you pause.
I don't justify and defend it.
Hendrik Hertzberg of New Yorker.
I'm trying to draw a narrower distinction.
What purpose does the distinction serve except to try to insinuate the point that somehow the killing of civilians, the deliberate, willful targeting of civilians by Israel is okay, whereas when Palestinians do that, it's beyond the pale.
Ali Abu Nibal, let's give Rick Hertzberg a chance to respond.
I don't think that the deliberate targeting of civilians is justifiable. If we're unable to distinguish, though, between these two kinds of violence, then I'm not sure where we find any hope at all in this situation. I believe that there ought to be a negotiated settlement between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I believe the United States should push for that. I think that we're in the situation now is absolutely disheartening and terrible, especially because this situation is produced an Israeli government that is far more unfriendly to compromise and peace than its predecessor. And I'm not an expert on any of this, but I do find it terribly disheartening, and would like to, rather than engage rather than be a punching bag or engage in mutual recriminations, discuss what might be done and what might be a basis for ending this terrible nightmare.
In your piece, Rick Hertzberg, you end by saying clearly the United States has to be involved with the solution. I think your last line was, you don't have to be Einstein to figure that out. I wanted to ask Ali Abu Nima what you think of the U.S. role in the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Well, I want to share the sentiment of Mr. Hertzberg that this is a terribly disheartening situation, and I have always advocated a negotiated settlement. But we can't really have a discussion about it if we're not prepared to face the basic facts about what military occupation is, what its goal is, which is to suppress and terrorize the entire civilian population, and to try to recast military occupation as if it is simply background instead of the main fuel of this conflict. So I think we need to be able to face the basic facts. As for the U.S. role, the U.S. is actively intervening in this conflict on the side of Israel. If there were any country in the world that were supplying the Taliban with billions of dollars worth of weapons and funds in order to fight the United States, we would not go around in our media pretending that that country was even-handed and was not taking sides. So I think that Mr. Herzberg, as a very prominent and well-respected person, needs to confront the strong elements in this community, in the United States, rather, which support the Sharon approach, support the illegal colonization of the occupied territories, and to demand that the United States stop supporting this in the name of the American community that supports Israel, Jewish and non-Jewish supporters of Israel, and to demand that we stop intervening on the side of Israel in this conflict. Until that happens, we're going to see this cycle continue, unfortunately, and the number of civilian deaths on either side, by every gruesome method that the Israelis and the Palestinians have yet devised, will unfortunately continue.
Rick Herzberg, you come to this with from an unusual perspective in that you traveled with President Carter to Israel as a speechwriter for him. So you go back many years on this conflict.
I do, although it's not something that I've frequently written about as a commentator. I did go with President Carter on his visit to Israel and Egypt, during which the treaty between those countries was kind of rescued from the problems that it had fallen into after Camp David. And certainly, if we're going to look at the history of this, the long history of it, it seems to me, perhaps I'm mistaken, that there have been a number of times over the years, and certainly that was one of them, 1979, when this conflict could have been resolved along lines of more favorable or as favorable to the Palestinians than what was discussed at Oslo and more, and recently at Camp David. And I think all of these things are tragic, and one of the tragedies seems to be that the Palestinians have never had a leadership capable of seizing the opportunities that come along to consolidate gains, to strike a compromise that would be beneficial to themselves. And it always seems to break down over what appear, at least from the outside, to be relatively minor details.
On that note, we have to wrap up the discussion. I want to thank Hendrik Herzberg for being with us, senior editor of the New Yorker magazine, and Ali Abu Nima, who is the vice president of the Arab American Action Network in Chicago. His offices set afire by an arsonist last week. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner, Suganya Mahendra, and Anthony Salone is our engineer and music maestro. You can hear us at WBIX.org. Go to our website at democracynow.org. Jackie Suen is our webmaster. We are broadcasting from downtown community television in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Stop sorrow with the poor. There's a song that